This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why do birds sing, and what are they singing about? My two guests are absorbed in those questions and get enormous pleasure from listening to birds sing. We're going to listen with them to some amazing recordings of birdsong. My guest, Donald Kruidsma, was recognized by the American Ornithologists Union in 2003 as the reigning authority on the biology of bird vocal behavior. He's written a new book about the art and science of birdsong called The Singing Life of Birds. Kruidsma is a visiting fellow at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. My guest, Don Stapp, is a nature journalist. His new book, Birdsong and Natural History, is in part about Kruidsma's field work. Stapp is a professor of English at the University of Central Florida. Don Stapp, Donald Kruidsma, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd actually like to start with birdsong, and what I'd like to do is play the song of the common yellow throat. And Donald Kruidsma, in this recording, we're going to hear it both ways. We're going to hear it at regular speed, and then we're going to hear it slowed down to half speed and then to quarter speed. Tell us what to listen for.
Well, this is a beautiful yellow bird with a black mask, in spite of that, called the common yellow throat. What you hear is a song with four phrases, and you might call it witchety, 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 witchety. And if we could actually look at the song graphs or sonograms for this bird, we would see those four phrases, and we'd see the little bits in each one of those phrases. And especially when we get it slowed down to one quarter speed, we'd see and hear each little note that that yellow throat is singing.
What should we listen for when it's slowed down? What can we hear that we couldn't hear at the regular speed?
Well, at regular speed, you'll hear pretty much a very rapid song. You'll hear notes slurred up and down the scale. You'll hear the partedness to it, the witchety, witchety, the three syllables in each of four phrases. But once you slow it down, you hear each one of those notes rising, and sometimes they'll rise, fall, and rise very rapidly. Things will still happen very rapidly, but if you could see this sonogram, see it in your mind's eye, you would see that sweep up and down very easily.
Here's the song of the common yellow throat, and we'll hear it at regular speed, and then we'll hear it slow down, and then slow down even more.
Fantastic.
You know, do you hear notes when it's slowed down that you didn't hear before, or variations in pitch that you didn't hear before?
I do. I hear more detail. I hear it sliding up and down. And also, the song, as it's slowed down to quarter speed, the pitch is dropped, too, to a better range of my hearing. So lots of little details come through that my ears are not fast enough to pick up at full speed.
Don Stapp, what do you hear in that?
Well, actually, what interests me about this is how much more Kruidsma hears than I hear to begin with. He's trained his ear to birdsong in a way that not too many people have.
Let's talk a little bit about the chickadee. Donald Kruidsma, would you describe the chickadee song before we actually hear it?
Yes, it's such a nice, simple song. And in the field guides, you'll see it described as fee-bee, but I personally prefer hey, sweetie. So throughout mainland North America, most of North America, you hear two main whistles. The first whistle's higher than the second, and there's a little break in the second whistle, so you hear two syllables. Hey, sweetie. So that's the mainland North America song. The Martha's Vineyard song, why, you've got something completely different there.
Now, do you write lyrics to most bird songs, like the hey, sweetie that you just described?
No, I don't write lyrics to most of them, but I needed something so that I could rephrase that lyric to accommodate all these variations on the vineyard. So on the vineyard, we have sweetie hay, for example, or sweetie sweetie, or so sweetie sweetie, to indicate where those little pauses are in the main whistles.
I'd say one thing about this, which is Don referring to it as hay sweetie, for instance, is something that naturalists have been doing for a long time because it was difficult to figure out how to remember what the song sounded like. So we involved all these mnemonic devices to remember bird songs. which are helpful if you've actually heard the bird song. If you haven't heard it, the mnemonic device is not going to help you much at all, I don't think. But so we've got all these, you know, the barred owl says, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" Is the phrase we use. And what, you know, bioacoustics has done in the last 50 years with tape recorders and audio spectrographs has made it possible to grasp these songs by looking at them on a graph and not needing to have to remember how they sounded. That's one of the things that sort of fascinated me, that this is sort of a relatively new science dealing with something that people have been fascinated about for really thousands of years.
Well, why don't we hear the black-capped chickadee's "Hey Sweetie" song, and here it is. For some reason, that bird song sounds so in sync with the Western scale. You know, that bird has perfect pitch. He keeps coming back to the same pitches, and then he changes key. it sounds so in sync. It sounds like the bird's been taking music lessons. And I'm not talking about like the beauty of the song, but just how it kind of fits in with the structure of Western music.
Yes, there is one thing you ought to know, and that is the pitch ratio between the "Hey" and the "Sweetie" stays constant as he transposes this song over this range. So it's really quite a remarkable song.
Is that atypical in birds?
Yes, I would say it is. I don't know, in fact, of any other examples where a bird does something exactly like this.
Are birds born with songs, or are they taught certain songs?
If we could have the answer to one question in all of bioacoustics, all those of us who study birdsong, I think we would love to know the answer to that question. Yes, these songbirds, 4,500 of them, learn to sing just like we learn to speak.
In what sense is it similar?
It's the learning component. The songbirds, 4,500, they have a sister group, a very closely related group, and the flycatchers belong to that group. In that group, the songs are more or less encoded right into the DNA. A young bird does not have to hear anything in order to know how to sing perfect songs for that species. But for these songbirds, this yellowthroat, this chickadee that we heard, these are songbirds. They have to hear from adults just as we, as people, as children, need to learn our speech patterns from parents. And young birds babble, young people babble. Birds have song dialects, and we certainly know that people have these same kinds of dialects. So striking similarities between how these songbirds acquire their songs, how we acquire our speech, and the parallels between them.
Well, on the CD that comes with your book, Donald Kruzma, you have one track of baby talk. Is that because you wanted to make that comparison between how certain young birds learn their songs and how babies learn to talk?
Yes, I love that comparison. We can listen to that track of my daughter when she's about a year and a half old. She's uttering all of these words in a nonsensical sequence, and we can tell where these words belong. She uses bow wow for dog, diddy for kitty, wee wee wee, and she hears the little piggy's homeward cry in the story that we've told to her over and over. And then you look at the song graphs or the sonograms for the adult wren and compare what the baby wren does. And you see this same kind of nonsensical sequence. Everything is taken out of context. The youngster is just babbling away, practicing everything. So my daughter and this young wren, these young songbirds, are doing exactly the same thing.
Well, let's start with your daughter. Here's your daughter babbling at a year and a half. Wa 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 wa. Okay, and why don't we now hear the adult wren and then the baby wren. What should we be listening for, Donald Kreutzmann?
Oh, with the adult wren, you'll hear four songs, and they are sharp and crisp, and this adult knows exactly what he's doing. And he'll sing one of these songs up to 50 times in a row, then he'll go to another one and sing that one 50 times in a row. But we're hearing just one example of each of these long series. Then you listen to the young bird, and you hear this amorphous babbling, and the little bits that will eventually become the adult song, they're all taken out of sequence. One is sung before the other. They're strung together in this long sequence, very unlike the sharp, crisp singing of the adult.
Okay, let's start with the adult wren. Okay, that was the adult wren, and let's hear the baby wren, who is just learning how to sing, and this is kind of like a babbling baby. It's a little, well, nonsensical. So, okay, we just heard the baby Buick wren imitating, not perfectly yet, what he's heard the adults sing. You actually had a breakthrough in studying wrens. You learned that they don't necessarily learn to sing from their fathers. They might learn from their neighbors. Can you talk a little bit about that breakthrough?
Yes. I was a graduate student at the time and looking for a good research project. And after a lot of reading, I realized that nobody really knows where a young bird gets its songs. Where, for example, these Buick's wrens that I was studying, where does that young male get his song? Well, the female doesn't sing. She's the architect of everything the male sings, but she doesn't actually sing. So the choices for a young male are either his father or other birds after this young male has left home. And what I found after a wee bit of work, banding lots of baby birds, putting little bands on their legs, following them along as they move from their birthplace to where they would settle for the rest of their lives, and this could be about a mile away or so, I found that these young birds were certainly capable of learning their father's songs, but then they rejected all of those songs so that they could sing the songs of the males that were around them on the territory that they would hold for the rest of their life. So they had to fit into this new community. Father's songs meant nothing in this new community because, after all, it was a different dialect, and dialects change over very short distances, up to a mile or so.
Don Stepp, what surprises you most about how birds learn to sing?
Well, all of this surprised me to begin with. You know, one thing that Don was not saying there, that as he was talking about his work on the Buick's wren, is that when he was doing that, the prevailing theory was otherwise, was that most birds learn from the father or at least adults in the area where they were born. And a lot of the work on song learning had been done in the laboratory with birds that were kept in soundproof cages and played songs to them over speakers. And by controlling all kinds of variables, people thought that, for instance, a bird would learn its song from beginning with day 6 to day 50 or so. And that seemed to be a really solid bit of evidence, but not many people have done much work in the field like this, which is more, I guess not more time-consuming work, but less predictable. I mean, Don had to, with these Buick's wrens, for instance, he spent 3 years at a wildlife refuge in Oregon going out and capturing, 300 adults over a period of a couple of years. That's not easy to do, chasing wrens around and chasing them into mist nets and banding them and making notes on, you know, who lives here, who lives there. And then more difficult yet, trying to catch the offspring of these wrens a year later and hoping he would catch enough of them and be able to then relocate them as they became adults to and match up numbers, you know, who's moved over here and is now singing like his new neighbors, as opposed to singing the song of the father he was born to. So that's something that really interested me when I was working on this book, was the way field work became increasingly, I think, important, and that the combination of field work and laboratory work is what gives you the most information, I think.
Well, let's hear another bird song, and I thought we could hear the song of the barred owl. And some of these sounds sound to me almost like chimps or roosters. They're really interesting. But before we actually hear a duet, a male-female duet of barred owls, let's start with a recording that just kind of is simple and breaks it down. Don Kruedsma, what are we going to hear?
Well, the first recording that we're going to hear, it's very simple. There are simply two sounds. The first is by the female, and the second is by the male. And what we've always known is that the female has a higher-pitched voice, even though she's much larger than he is. This is just the reverse of most birds. Even though she's much larger than he is, the pitch of her voice is a little higher. So the first sound that you hear is a you-all by the female, and the second one is the you-all by the male. So listen for the higher pitch in the first one, the lower pitch in the second one. And then what became part of my story was I discovered that the female has much more vibrato. It's a you-all, and it drags on, whereas the male just stops short, you-all. So go ahead.
Okay, here it is.
You hear the striking difference in both the pitch
uh-huh.
and the amount of vibrato.
Uh-huh. Well, you want to hear a duet now? What should we listen for?
Sure, let's listen to a duet. So now that we know the key difference in how to tell male and female, now you can start to tell, who's contributing and actually how to this duet. So you always listen for this pitch difference, the higher one being the female. But then when the sounds are so different, you can no longer rely on the pitch. Then you rely on that vibrato to tell which is the male and which is the female.
Okay, let's hear it. That is so wonderful.
Wow.
That's really great.
If you come across birds like this in the dark, it sends shivers up and down your spine. It is scary. It sounds like two huge cats caterwauling. And my favorite part is the last part of that recording, because it is there that the male, it's like he's opened up his mouth and it's given this really hooting ha-ha-ha sound, but you hear her accompanying in the background with that wonderful vibrato that you all, as he's cackling in the foreground. I love that sound.
They make a bunch of other really strange sounds, too. I've told Don this recently a number of times. We have a pair of barred owls on our property right now. I mean, one of the great joys has been these two owls that have been there for the last year, and they hang around the house. They sit on our deck, and they kind of keep an eye on the bird feeder. They sit sitting on the bird bath someday, and they've been making a lot of noise the last few weeks. It's spring down here, and they make the strangest sounds. Besides that sort of basic call we just heard, and you know, again, some of this stuff is I take on a real personal level. I mean, that when Don said, "Oh, the female has that vibrato at the end," I thought, now I can tell which is which.
My guests are nature journalist Don Stapp, author of Birdsong, A Natural History, and ornithologist Donald Kruedsma, author of the new book, The Singing Life of Birds. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guests are ornithologist Donald Kruzma, author of the new book, The Singing Life of Birds, and nature journalist Don Stapp, author of Birdsong and Natural History. Donald Kruzma, I've been choosing all the tracks from the CD that comes with your book, and there's, you know, like about 90 tracks on it. I want to ask you to choose a personal favorite or one that's particularly popular with people. Would you do that?
Oh, my favorites, I think I always gravitate towards the thrushes, the wood thrush, the hermit thrush. They are routinely considered among the most beautiful songs in North America. And I think there's one figure in the book where I tend to go when I have nothing else to do, and sometimes that happens. I just want to look at this figure and connect with it again. It's the song of the wood thrush. And let's first listen to a normal wood thrush singing at normal speed. And what I'd like to have you hear are these soft little bup, bup, bup notes at the beginning of the song, and then a loud, bold, whistled prelude, and then the ending, what I would call a flourish. And that flourish happens so rapidly that we can't appreciate what's going on. So let's listen first to the overall details of roughly 10 songs.
Okay. So those were some of the details of some of the songs of the wood thrush. What should we hear now?
Okay, so we heard that loud prelude in the middle of the song and then the ending flourish. I want to zoom in on that flourish on the end because to our ears, things happen so quickly there that it sounds like just a blur. But what happens when you pull this song apart and slow it down to 1/10 its normal speed? It is just exquisite. Because this wood thrush, like so many songbirds, uses two voice boxes simultaneously. So he's singing a duet with himself. And so you can look at the sonogram, and these are a figure in the book. You can see the contribution from his left voice, and you can see the contribution from his right voice box. And in some songs, the left and right are tightly coordinated, beautiful sine waves moving in harmony across the page. But in others, the two voice boxes are quite independent. But whether they're tightly coordinated or independent, the effect is just really striking. So in this next recording, what I've done is to present only the left voice box first, be just a few seconds long, 5 seconds maybe, then 5 seconds of the right voice box, and then you hear the left and the right together in harmony. So go ahead and play that.
Okay.
So that was one of those flourishes, if we could pause there just a minute. So the left and the right voice boxes in that first flourish are doing something quite different. In this next one, the left voice box and the right voice are doing pretty much the same thing. They're beautiful sine waves in the figure, but they're non-overlapping in pitch. So the first voice box is low pitched, the second one is higher pitched, and you play the two together and you just feel this wonderful harmony. Stunning.
And is there a third part now?
We should listen to just one more. I'd love to listen to all 6 of them on this page, but let's listen to one more because I love this one. It reminds me of my piano lessons that I failed as a youngster. Because the two voices, you can just see it. The one voice goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And on every one, the left voice box gives a good solid one. So it's you feel the emphasis. So for every four sweeps of the right voice box, the left voice box is making only one sweep. So listen to the slow sweeps of the left voice box first, then the rapid ones, four times as rapid in the right, and then the beautiful coordination, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
That was really wonderful. That's the song of the wood thrush. And, well, I thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Ornithologist Donald Kruedsma is the author of The Singing Life of Birds, The Art and Science of Listening to Birdsong, which comes with the Birdsong CD. Journalist Don Stapp is the author of Birdsong, A Natural History.